Jackanoid Paralope is a mission-driven media company. Check out more of our podcasts at jackanoidparalope.com. Jackanoid Paralope!
The essential role of the artist is to be able to see what's unseen.
The role of the artist can vary, but principally, I think it's about cultivating the imaginary.
Being a creative puts you back in touch with what it means to be a human. And there's so much in the world right now that kind of seeks to strip us of our humanity.
From Jackanoid Paralope, this is Artist Led, a podcast about artists who have moved beyond the proverbial studio to lead efforts around systems change and community well-being. The first episode of this season, Guides on the Ground, introduced listeners to the key players and concepts surrounding this work and the sector of community development investment. This episode, we'll hear excerpts from a conversation between show host Nathaniel Crusson and Bradley Pitts, the founder of Place, a regenerative farm project in Copaig, New York.
Hardest question first. What is your name and what do you do in life?
I'm Bradley McGilvery Pitts. I'm a father, husband, artist, and currently working on a regenerative farm in upstate New York.
I love the father first. What drew you to working at the intersection of arts and communities, and how has your focus evolved over time?
Yeah, so for the past 20 plus years, I've mainly been a sculptor and installation artist, but having kids really kind of transformed my interests, my life. I've found that I became less interested in making work for exhibition and much more interested in nature and ecology and our relationship to that. I grew up in Manhattan, but spent a lot of time in the woods of Westchester and camping all over the Southeast, where my extended family is. So, returning to a focus with nature feels a little bit like a homecoming after having studied engineering and art and many different things. Right now I'm just really excited by the possibility of serving nature, serving the wild in the process of meeting human needs.
Yeah, you kind of brought it to the exact place I wanted to bring it to, which is impact. In terms of capturing that impact and that shifting interest of yours, moving away from exhibition to things that are based in real world, ecology, yeah, all that stuff, have you had success stories you can share in terms of like capturing the impact that's possible with this kind of work?
Yeah, so part of my journey has been, reading a lot, educating myself, and again, in large part motivated by having something to offer my kids in this regard. But that turned into teaching a class at SUNY Purchase that was basically a nature connection class for art students. And that was just a really powerful experience working with the students and getting their, positive feedback. But in that class, we were working with foraged plant material on campus. We were reading an anthology put together by a Lenape group, because the campus is on Lenape homelands. And then I was asking the students to do their own kind of ancestry research to understand when their people were disconnected from the land. And it just, it seemed to really resonate with the students and change their perspective of, their campus as well as, their life at large. So I feel like that's kind of the crown jewel I'm holding on to in terms of like this works, this makes a difference. Some students were saying they feel it should be a required course for everyone on campus. I was blown away by how moved they seem to be by it. Yeah.
There are two things that really jump out at me from that crown jewel, as you put it. One is With forged materials, you make art more approachable and less cost prohibitive. Like, people can literally look around and just make whatever the heck they want. And it's somehow evocative of where they are in time and place. Like, it's not being shipped from overseas.
Right.
It's not, you know, been made 10 years ago and being restored or whatever, the freshest new thing. It's like, what's here and now is what we got. So yeah. What can we make with it?
Yeah.
And the other thing that jumped out at me was looking into their own past and legacy through their family's separation from the land. How would you define separation from the land? How do you kind of like guide that exercise?
Yeah. To your first point, I think it's been very powerful for me, liberating, but also it's like maybe a reminder of, I think it was for the students too, that like, literally everything comes from nature. Like, no matter what piece of technology you're holding, like all of those things were foraged from nature and processed and assembled. So yeah, wanted to say that. And then what was the second part you're asking?
Separation from the land. What does that actually mean?
Yeah,
how
yeah,
did you
yeah.
kind of send them on that hunt?
Yeah. So, you know, I kept the definition of ancestry very broad. You know, some of us have more access to our like genealogy, like literal blood ancestry than others. I think there's also like an ancestry of culture or even like an intellectual ancestry. I let students be very kind of flexible about that. I think, you know, as I've, from my studies, our kind of obsession with blood ancestry is a very particular Western, maybe white obsession that doesn't extend to, I would say, most cultures around the world, as evidenced by like many cultures use the term aunt and uncle or auntie and uncle, like in a much broader sense that has nothing to do with blood lineage. It's more about community and relationship. You know, I guess we would talk about it in terms of, this idea of like homelands, and what would you consider those people's homelands? And when was that interrupted either through, you know, displacement or through, you know, some sort of changed practice?
So you're talking a lot about indigenous lands. You're talking about types of farming, and something that came up on a recent design team call that I've listened to you kind of talk about this project was this idea of perennial farming versus, you know, what's the other one? Not perennial.
Conventional or annual.
Annual. Okay. So I was thinking that there was a more complex term than annual.
No,
okay, cool. All right, cool. Sometimes you just got to go simple. All right. So largely you were talking about, we don't think about perennial crops as a way to limit carbon emissions, keep things basically, you know, simple and regenerative and all that stuff. And your project is kind of tackling a lot of different fronts in terms of like land back efforts with native populations, with perennial farming, like kind of give an overview of this, like, ginormous bite of the cookie that you're kind of like taking here.
Totally. Yeah. So just on a kind of, let's say, like pure data science climate level, clearly there's a lot of emphasis on reducing carbon emissions. There's a lot of emphasis on sequestering carbon. And there's a lot of research suggesting that soil is maybe one of the biggest carbon sinks around, that doesn't require new inventions, new machinery to suck carbon out of the air, like the microbes and the plants. And those are the machines that will pump the carbon back into the soil. But it requires you use specific methods. You know, it's still an evolving field. So I think there's some ideas of best practices, but certainly room for innovation. But one practice, as you mentioned, you know, annual annual crops require tilling and seeding every year. But when you till, there is such thing as no-till, and that's on the spectrum. But in contemporary conventional farming, tilling is still the dominant practice. When you do that, you're breaking up the soil structure, the fungal structure, and actually releasing a lot of carbon. So keeping the soil intact, there's many methods of how to keep the soil intact, still plant, and actually build soil while you're still growing a crop. So that's like the regenerative aspect of, that's what that term is referring to. Perennial agriculture, clearly you don't have to keep disturbing the soil if you've got, whether it be orchards. I think orchards is the easy image for us to conjure of like a perennial agriculture. But there's a lot of, nuts, fruit, even some vegetable, leafy greens that are perennial. So there's a lot more nutrition that we could be growing, in a perennial regenerative way than most of us are used to in our current diet. Since owning land, owning this land upstate, I've been building a relationship with the Mohican Nation, and that there's a whole backstory to that. But wanting to reintroduce and rebuild those relationships between the indigenous folks of the land and the land itself. Certainly, I want to work towards cultural easements and other things that allow tribal members to access the land if they find that valuable. And I hope there will also be a Mohican guest house that would be kind of free lodging for tribal members visiting the homelands, because often that's the highest cost barrier to coming east. So that's another element. And then I don't know if we've mentioned yet that the farm will also contain affordable housing. So, but then on all those levels, right, like the question is still, even with housing, can you build a house, develop land in a way that also serves the wild? To our, especially, in the West, I feel like too many of us have been taught that kind of like humans can only have a negative impact on the natural world, quote unquote, natural world. But many people, mostly in indigenous communities, have very long histories of being actually the keystone species in their ecology. So like, how can we find our way back to that? And I don't have, certainly don't have all the answers. This is like a laboratory to pursue answers and pursue implementation. So trying to find ways that we can kind of, crack that nut.
So I think the one question I want to ask in response to that is, how did this project with all these different facets, this octopus of a project that you're doing, how did it evolve? And maybe also the most sensitive part of it is opening up those relationships back with members of the Mohican Nation, because I think there's a big inherent, whether it's shame, whether it's guilt, whether it's fear, that prevents those conversations from even starting. Because if you're afraid you're not going to be able to deliver a true solution, you might not even ask the question. But you're out front and you're with this project asking those questions. So, what was it like to open those conversations, and how did the project with all these different facets to it kind of come together?
My family and I purchased land in 2020 up there. It was at a time, obviously COVID. I was in a lot of virtual spaces that either were reading land acknowledgements or encouraging folks to kind of introduce themselves, including, whose homelands they were on or what watershed they were in. Or so as tokenistic as those gestures can be at times, for me it really worked. And I was like, yeah, why don't I know, you know, the original people of this land, or really anything about them? It really, you know, woke me up to like, wait, biodiversity is here. Like the Northeast woodlands are no less valuable or amazing, you know, or inspiring than the Amazon. Like, it's just, they're my backyard, so I've ignored them. Indigenous folks, you know, are still here, and, you know, the communities that aren't in their homelands, where are they? Like, I can find out and build those relationships. And that's just as like powerful and meaningful. So that was like the process with the kind of indigenous connection. And I reached out to the Mohican representatives and kind of started a conversation and, you know, put my foot in my mouth a few times and made bad mistakes and just, you know, apologized and kept going, which is the teaching that I hear coming through indigenous authors and others that I listen to, that there's, you know, this idea of perfection is a very problematic kind of particularity of Western, if not white, culture.
I've heard the same thing. And just to drive it home, you made an attempt, you made some mistakes, and the world didn't end. You were able to move forward.
Right. Yeah.
I just wanted to underscore that.
Thank you. And, you know, thankfully, I'm grateful that they didn't, you know, write me off immediately. But yeah. And I have contacts with conservationists, ecologists, other people. And every time, you know, one of them came over, I'd be like, help me understand, what does this land want? And they'd basically be like, well, it depends what you want from it. And I was like, no, it's not about me. It's, you know, so I'm trying to understand, teach me how to listen to the land and like understand what it wants. Then a partner and I bought adjacent parcels to the land, and that became, okay, now we have actually a sizable amount of land. That business partner helped write the town's new zoning around affordable housing. And she really wants to see that put into practice. So she was kind of driving the, or she is maybe driving the affordable housing conversation piece, which was something I was interested in, but I didn't really have any, you know, that was going to be a whole other thing I needed to learn. So it was very serendipitous that we were both interested in doing something with this land. And I would say, you know, this might change, but today I would say like the answer to my question of like, what does this land want is kind of all about like bringing the beings back, like bringing the animals, including humans, back to the land.
You've already touched on a bunch of the questions that I wanted to ask specifically about the project. The part of this project that is asking how to make it an investable project. Right. How can we rethink doing good things from a business perspective? How would you kind of map out how this thing, to put it bluntly, makes money back to investors who are aligned in vision with you that want to see these same goals achieved, but are either, you know, have responsibility to people they manage funds on behalf of, or like whatever else? How does it actually function in the very Western mindset of success equals money?
Yeah.
And we're saying, take a more nuanced view. It's not all or nothing. It's not all good. We can, you know, meet you halfway. But how does that halfway actually look?
Yeah. So I think, as usual with me, there's several parts of that answer. Let's see, just in terms of income, you know, the farm is going to be selling. I think it's looking like it's going to be a hybrid model of like a plant nursery. So selling kind of plant stock, as well as, you know, harvested and sold products, including food, medicine, and kind of craft related. Like willow whips or other things for basket making. And in terms of investors, you know, my hope is that this bond will be designed, this community bond will be designed such that my kind of direct neighbors or within a certain radius get the opportunity at like a very low minimum investment, and you know, a return rate that's comparable or maybe better than a savings account these days. You know, if we think of some nonprofits or others in the area, this project actually serves one of their core missions. So if you think of like a conservation organization that's interested in protecting and supporting wildlife, I think the pitch there is like, you have an endowment, you expect a certain return from that endowment, but most likely your portfolio in that endowment isn't actually achieving your mission. And it might actually be working against your mission depending on where you're invested. So like, why don't you take a little bit of a cut on the return, but invest in this, and now you're actually serving your mission while you're also getting a return. So I think the pitch in many ways is philanthropy with a return.
In terms of thinking about the bigger picture, right, I want to ask you, because you have this artist background and you're still an right. artist, and you've taken a more community focused, kind of like ecocentric, world focused view as to how you play a role within it, how would you articulate the ways that artists can play a meaningful role in helping communities?
Yeah, absolutely. In that transition I talked about from kind of being more sculpture exhibition focused to land focused, you know, in that same vein, one way I put it is, you know, I've become less interested in authorship and more interested in stewardship. So I think artists, there's many ways I think artists are qualified to do this work, in part that we're always in some gray zone in the middle or on the fringes. So I think it's kind of one of our core skills to be able to survey and follow, you know, different zones of interest, regardless of any sort of cultural or business silos. And then, you know, our work is about synthesizing in many ways. So I think, you know, that makes me think of, you know, artists as having the ability to kind of imagine futures that don't exist yet. I think that's like a core component. I also think, so especially in Copake, there's a very interesting dynamic of, it's close enough to Boston and New York City that you have, you know, second homeowners from those urban places. So you get some overlap from these urban places, but then you also have, you know, a lot of long-time, full-time residents. So you have this, it's kind of like a nice Venn diagram of these differences, socioeconomic, urban, rural. There is some racial diversity, though not as much as the city, of course. But political diversity is way, way bigger than in my experience of the city. So I really see artists having a powerful role to call people in.
That's really great. A very tactile thing that I discovered was people who we depend on as communities, plumbers, electricians, all that stuff, can't afford to live there anymore because of the influx of second home buyers.
Right.
And so just through the affordable housing piece, and you mentioned workforce earlier, we once again help the ecosystem of community, kind of like we foster a little bit of that. To wrap up with you, thank you for all the great stuff you've given me this interview. What would you say is anything that we haven't covered about your efforts, the larger picture, that you think is essential to the conversation?
I mean, the one other piece, I guess, that I'm thinking about, and I guess it relates to investors, but also the kind of human ecosystem. You know, I think COVID gave us a taste of this, but I'm not sure we really embodied and, you know, focused on the lesson there of kind of how the vulnerability of the least of us is the vulnerability of all of us. you know, we can talk about it in terms of food security or food sovereignty. We can talk about it on like an ecosystem climate level. You know, this is just a small piece of the world, but maybe there's a way to link up with other similar projects or kind of expand it further to think of that kind of insurance policy that helps everyone.
You're nothing if not a connector, Bradley.
Yeah. My mind goes all over.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I feel good. You feel good?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks so much for your time, dude.
Yeah, dude. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds great. Bye. Bye.
The uncut version of this interview is available on the Jackanoid Paralobe Substack channel. Please take a moment to rate this show, smash that follow button, and leave any thoughts or ideas in the comments. We do read them. If you're hungry for more stories that dwell on the intersection of creativity, community, and social good, visit jackanoidparalobe.com to explore our full catalog of shows. For exclusive access to bonus content, subscriber perks, and advanced looks at new releases, join the Jackanoid Paralobe community on Substack.